Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is The Guardian.
The cost of imposing a new law in the real world is you give police greater powers and the resources to go about their business. Online, you're interrupting the business models of the largest companies on earth. So it's a harder ask. And you can see the pushback around the world, but I guess there is the appetite for government to step up in this place.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Guardian Australia's Chief Political Correspondent, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. And today I'm here with Peter Lewis, the Executive Director of Essential Media. How's it going, Peter?
Very good, Paul. Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be talking about the latest Guardian Essential poll, and this fortnight voters were asked about the current national debate about online safety reform and the spread of violent content on social media platforms. In the wake of the alleged stabbing at the Wakeley Church and the attack at Bondi Junction, the poll also canvassed views on crime reduction and prevention. But first off, Peter, let's discuss how concerned people are by different types of crime. What did you find there?
Well, we asked a couple of questions. One was level of concern. And I must say, this is in the climate where there just seems to have been just a constant stream of horrific stories. And I know that particularly with gendered violence, it is an ongoing stream, but that added with the stabbing in the church, the Westfield attacks, it feels like a series of black swan moments at the one time. And so we were interested in testing whether that is registering with the public and then, you know, ultimately where that leads in terms of voter behaviour. On your first question, concern is high. It's in the 80s for just about every category. So the highest level of concern is youth crime. And it's a couple laps back, but there was quite an outbreak of concern around youth crime in regional areas in both New South Wales and Queensland that's led to some tough law and order responses by state Labor governments that aren't without their controversy. Family violence, unsurprisingly, again, in the high 70s, gender-based crime in the 70s. The only one that was a bit lower was terrorism, which was kind of used to be the flashpoint for community concern. I think what we're seeing here is that whereas particularly if we think back to post 9/11 and Bali, where the threat was out there, it feels to me like people are seeing the threat being closer to home in their communities, in the families. And as we found in a second question about do you feel safe, which is a pretty basic question for a society online as well.
Yeah, and I guess how concerned are you leaves open to them whether you're asking about how likely something is to happen, how bad it would be if that thing did happen, or whether it's a mix of those things. So presumably youth crime is high because people think it's more likely to happen.
Well, concerned that it is happening as well. So I've got a bit of a theory that crime plays out particularly in times of financial insecurity as kind of two sides of the coin, a bit like the way that I thought border protection was the other side of the coin when it came to terrorism, which is like, God, 20 years ago now, but it had a long tail life. And so you're right, there is, are you concerned about crime? But then that, do you feel personally safe? What I think is really interesting there is that overall, we had four categories: in your workplace, in your home, in your community, online. 12% of people say they don't feel safe in their workplace, and that's where people feel the safest, but the majority feel safe. In your home, again, it was 12% who either feel very unsafe. That's a low number, but still a significant part of the population, 3%, 9% quite unsafe. But then in the community, it's up to 21%. One in five people say they don't feel safe in their community, and it gets up to 36% online. Like, over a third of people say they're not feeling safe online. Now, I guess feeling safe is a bit like feeling in love. You can't quite define it, but you know when you're in it. But I found that a really striking sort of anchor point for the sorts of law and order debates that come out the other end.
Can't define it, but know it when I see it. Isn't that what a member of the US Supreme Court said about pornography? I think that...
Are you segueing here?
I think that might take us into the next topic, because 64% of people said they felt safe online, 36% said they felt unsafe. But then when you asked about various government interventions to improve online safety, people wanted lots of action.
You'd have to say support for government intervention online is vociferous. We did check in on people's view of the e-safety commissioner's showdown with Elon Musk, where we break 70-30 in favour of the e-safety commissioner in her court action against Elon Musk to globally take down some of the images from the attack on the Archbishop.
And you gave people a bit of what each was arguing. It wasn't just a name recognition thing.
It wasn't like, who do you like? Like, in fact, If I was reading the fine print, I'm happy to read it. I probably wouldn't be in the 70%. But the Australian eSafety Commissioner argues that social media platforms need to remove dangerous content that can be accessed by Australians wherever it appears, versus Elon Musk argues the Australian eSafety Commissioner requiring X to remove content it deems as dangerous outside of Australia is an attempt to censor the internet and restrict free speech. And I think the free speech argument's really interesting in the context of what's going on online. There's always been this freedom doctrine around the internet, the early days of the internet in the US. Section 230 of the Communications Act was this idea that the internet was nothing more than a set of pipes. It was neutral what was flowing through them, and there was no responsibility on the people that built the pipes on what was going through. And I think particularly with the rise of platforms and the way that algorithms affect the way content is served up, that is changing. And so libertarians might say that's impinging on my freedom, or tech billionaires might say that's impacting on my freedom. The other way of framing this is to say that we are asserting our freedom to create a safe place on the internet, and people are really up for that at the moment. Make it illegal to post sexualized deepfake images. 80% support, with a very small 6% saying they don't support that. Enforce age verification for pornography and gambling sites. That's again at 80%. Age verification in social media, pretty much the same, 77%. An increased capacity for law enforcement to scrutinise online behaviour, that's in the mid-60s. So it's almost like you can't come up with a government intervention that people don't support, which feels a little bit like where we were with housing about a month ago. We're in this era where people, it feels to me, are looking for the government to take action. And that's a different climate to some periods in the past where, you know, the prevailing thing was just get out of the way, government, and let us go about our business. So the only other thing I'd point out there, Paul, is there are big age differences in attitudes. Mm. So if you are like me, over 55, it's in the 90s, high 80s. For younger respondents, it's still in the 60s, but there's a 25-30% difference. So in banning sexualized deepfake images, we've got only 65% of young people. Now, there is a cohort there that is saying don't know, but it is much lower than older voters. So there is this kind of also counterintuitive that the older and by definition more conservative voters are actually also calling on government to intervene in a more meaningful way.
And just to run through those options that people were given, making it illegal to post deepfake porn, that's something that National Cabinet agreed last week, so that's approving a measure that the government's going on with. Age verification, for gambling already happens because you've got to be of age or you can't deposit into the account. But for pornography, that would be a new reform. The coalition's pushing Labor to do that. And there was money for a trial of age verification technology announced last week. Age verification on social media, their own policies say that you're supposed to be at least 13, but those aren't really enforced. So it's something the government could do is force social media companies to do that. So,
but can I just say on that, that it also goes into a broader part of the current government reform agenda, and they are making a torturous journey through a process of reform at the moment. I think last week the AG said that we can look for laws to be sort of put on the table early August, but they will be very significant because just think about it a little bit. It sounds great for age verification, but who is capturing that data and who is holding that data and under what rules is that data being held? We're seeing this play out in a lot of different ways. There was the breach of facial recognition technology from the club in Sydney last week, and there's no regulation on facial recognition in Australia at the moment either. So it's kind of like you can do this sort of whack-a-mole government intervention, but there are also the foundation blocks that are really, really important.
Yes, I got a text from the Dixon Tradies saying that my license is out there. So you did ask who would you trust to verify your age and identity online? And I thought it was interesting that the trust measure was a little bit lower than the are you in favour of it measure.
Well, yeah. So 43% would trust the government. We also gave options of businesses whose services I access. People don't really want that, and their lived experience is that that stuff gets hacked, only 14%. We put the idea of not-for-profit third parties, which is just a concept at the moment, 12%, and then 30%, no one, none of these. So that is one of the challenges. And I think policing the internet does have a range of challenges that sit under. It's not as easy. Well, by analogy, it's not easy, but the cost of imposing a new law in the real world is you give police greater powers and the resources to go about their business. Online, you're interrupting the business models of the largest companies on earth. So it's a harder ask. And you can see the pushback around the world when rules are being put in place. And it's both the platforms and then the businesses that use the platforms and all of them who are making they're living out of the extraction of data that just don't want these changes. So it does take real government intervention. But I guess back to the earlier findings, there is the appetite for government to step up in this place. And, you know, unlike a lot of the law and order areas where federal government is kind of the funder and the auspice, on communications, they're actually the main regulator. So they do have the levers to pull if they choose to.
Mm. And you did ask a question that goes to people's general attitude of how to approach crime, a more punitive approach or a preventative approach. What did you find there?
So, yeah, I know it's a false binary, but it's the old George Lakoff daddy approach, which is the strict rule-setting father, and the mummy approach, which is the nurturing systemic mother. Total stereotype, total false binary, but we put it out there to see where people land. 59-41 towards the daddy state. I did posit that that's actually interesting in the broader political context. Going back to my black swan observation, I guess my fun fact of the week is that a collective noun for swans in flight is a wedge. And I think there is the risk that on law and order, Labor could be wedged, particularly when the opposition leader is the personification of the daddy state, the former Queensland copper who's never quite, you know, shaken that vibe. And also the fact that Labor government's a wall-to-wall mainland, that if this sense that there is crime as a defining issue that sits underneath cost of living and housing and it comes to life, I think that is a real challenge for Labor because it kind of is off-brand.
Yeah, and although it's split more in favour of harsher penalties and more enforcement than more prevention, when you put individual measures in those two buckets, you know, enforcement or prevention, people said yes to all of them.
Give us the lot. Again, doesn't it remind you of the housing options? Even when you get things that are kind of potentially contradictory, people are saying, yeah, give us all of it. So we can go down the list if people are interested.
Just pick out a few.
Well, you know, the big ones increase access. So in terms of preventative measures, 80% support for programs to intervene with at-risk groups, mental health and drug rehab, affordable housing. So all those systemic things people really want, but they also want enforcement measures at a slightly higher level, high 80s up to 90, more cops, stricter laws and harsher penalties, stronger police powers. And so, again, that tends to be the role of states. What we're seeing, particularly in New South Wales, is an assertion of running tougher bail laws to deal with issues around law and order and trying to be out-toughing the Conservative parties. I don't know if that's ever possible for a Labor government. I think back in the day, in an earlier life, I worked in the first term of the Carr government, where the way Bob Carr used to frame it was tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime. And I think that's probably the way that you can get state Labor governments holding it. Like, you deal with the law and order issues, but you don't just do it as a performative piece. You're actually looking at what's going on under the surface as well. Do you like my Bob Carr impersonation? They didn't quite own it, but it creeps up on you when you spend enough time
I was getting flashbacks of him walking up a train station platform in an election ad talking about being tough on crime when he was against Kerry Chikarovsky. So
the opposition leader whose name he never mentioned once.
It's obviously drilled into my brain sufficiently to remember that. Let's talk about one category of violence in particular, which is family violence, which was a large focus of National Cabinet last week. That also produced an all-of-the-above type response when you put a number of measures to people.
The headline is people want action, and we can unpack a little bit more about what that says about that in a moment, but don't want to be at all flippant going through some of these findings. So, provide more services for women impacted by family violence, 80%. Revise the current bail laws to make it harder for men accused of family violence to access bail, and that's 77%. I'm looking at whether 7% opposed, and we can do the gender split in a sec because I think it's interesting. Share intelligence of alleged domestic violence perpetrators between states. Well, of course, like these are kind of like, you feel almost embarrassed asking these questions. They're all in the sort of 70s to 80s. Make coercive control a criminal offence. I know there's been some really effective campaigning for this. That's got huge support. It's in the mid-70s. Invest in behaviour change measures with respect to relationships, 71, and invest in measures to address gender inequality and improve women's economic empowerment, again, 65%. They are all things that are not 50-50 propositions. The gender split, unsurprisingly, women are more supportive, but it's like, it's a degree of 10%. It's not like a polarising position.
What about the 64% who support investing in measures to address gender inequality and improve women's economic empowerment? Was the gap about the same there?
It was 69-59, so it was a 10% gap, but it's not, I think we are in a moment where, regardless of gender, just coming to terms with the fact that it is, for some women, such a dangerous existence. And, you know, there's been some very intelligent commentary, and I'm not going to presume to sort of step into the role of people like Jess Hill and Waleed Ali. Like, these people have thought about this really deeply, but I think people are also feeling it. And there is a moment, like we call it the Overton window, where some really significant change can occur. And I think, going back to the beginning of our discussion, that is around really grappling with the reality of the threat that we see to women, but also doing unfinished business on starting to create safe online environments as part of that systemic discussion. And yeah, it's hard. Like, you've got to upset some of the existing ways that very powerful companies make their money, but the public will back you for it. And I think it speaks to that bigger piece that I alluded to earlier, that just there is an appetite for government to do stuff and take on particularly powerful interests. So I think one of the difficulties in government is that you manage all the stakeholders and you look for the centre grounds and the ways through. And sometimes that ends you up feeling like you're sitting in the middle or just being, the moment plays you rather than you playing the moment. But you can see here an opportunity for some social reforms that will make society safer and better, And I think the government would receive support across society if it can find a way of really delivering that.
Mm. Now, I don't want to sully our podcast with the horse race of the two-party preferred, you did ask which political party was most trusted to deal with crime or community safety. What did you find there?
So I just want to explain the construction of this question because I was testing out a little theory, right, which was that if you ask which party is better at managing crime, it would be different to community safety, mainly because it's a slightly different frame. And I was wrong. So we did what we call a split sample. So we do 1,000 people. And so we asked half of them one question, half of them the other question. So which party do you trust most to deal with the issue of crime? Labor 31, Coalition 28, No Difference 41. When you shift it to which party do you trust most to create a safe community? Labor, same number, 31. Libs down 4, 24. No Difference up 45. Now, two things stand out. One is that given that we're in this moment of wall-to-wall state mainland Labor governments and a national Labor government and a series of really traumatic crime events, the Libs aren't hitting the politics out of the park at the moment. But there is a big hole in that. I think both sides of politics are seeing like the No Difference, none of them is the winner on both those levels. So A, maybe my smarty pants trying to frame it, safety crime doesn't really matter to people. They see it as the same thing at the end. But more critically, there is 40% of the electorate that's sitting there not making a call one way or the other. Is there any major differences? Younger people more likely to say Labor on both, but also more likely to say No Different. It's just, as we say many times, under 34, the coalition's got real, real issues.
And now that we're in the political frame of mind, do people think that next Tuesday's budget is going to make any difference to the cost of living?
Not really. All up 9 say yes, it definitely will. 21, it probably will. The majority, and I'm saying 59%, either say no, it probably won't, or no, it definitely won't. Differences there, women a little bit negative about it, younger people a little bit more positive about it. And unsurprisingly, if you're a progressive voter, your hopes are a little bit higher, but it's still majority saying No Difference. And that's interesting, Paul, isn't it? Like, are budgets these days circuit breakers or are they just part of the wall of noise? And yeah, that's probably more for you to reflect on than me. And we'll be back in a fortnight where we can see if it has made a difference. But what do you make of that last set of numbers?
Well, it's consistent with governments not getting budget bounces in recent years. I'm surprised to hear young people are more optimistic because there were some positive changes on HECS debts and practical placements announced on Sunday and Monday. But this poll was in the field in the 5 days leading up to Sunday. So that wasn't captured. And yet they're quite positive. Women, less positive, but some of the announcements that have already been made, like super unpaid parental leave, primarily to benefit women. So that was interesting to see. But in general, the fact that people don't think they're going to be better off from budgets, no, that doesn't really surprise me.
It's a tough gig trying to, A, manage the nation's finances, but then turn that into something that people are going to write songs about. I don't know. I think the only one that I can remember recently was Back in Black, which never was quite black anyway, was it? But it rocked out for a couple of weeks.
On Tuesday, we'll find out if Labor books their second budget surplus and we'll be back in a fortnight with Peter to discuss if there's a budget bounce.
Maybe we can find a new song to rock out to, Paul.
If there's another budget before the next election and that is in deficit, then Labor's message at the election will be 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Look out.
Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thanks, Paul.
This episode was produced by James Milsom and Alison Chan. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. I'm Paul Karp. Thanks for listening.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.